This podcast is brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those that love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew. For this week's episode, I'm in Sarasota, Florida, on the west coast of Florida, for a brewery that's been on our radar for a number of years, a brewery that made it on Alex Kidd's critics list a few years back in Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine as one of his top three breweries of the year. Calusa Brewing is the brewery, and joining me here is Jason Thompson, one of the founders of Calusa and head brewer. Welcome to the podcast, Jason.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your title is head brewer, right?
Head brewer, co-owner.
Yep. Co-owner, exactly. Cool. I got it right. Just want to make sure. You know, we're going to talk about like what Calusa is most well known for, which is hazy IPA. Something that we actually haven't talked that much about on the podcast lately, although we're going to hit a little stride with hazy IPA over this episode and the next one. You know, it's funny, the lager brewing takes up most brewers' minds right now, even if hazy IPA may be paying some bills for a lot of folks. It is what it is. Calusa not only makes hazy IPA, make all sorts of beers. You make lagers as well. Mixed fermentation beers are, you know, a big thing, you know, part of your core love. And you also do some barrel aging. We're sitting here in the old tap room surrounded by barrels here. Maybe we'll talk about that. We'll see where the time goes. And if we, you know, if we end up on that subject, but we're definitely going to talk about beers on the hazier end of the hoppy beer spectrum. Before we do that, at G&D Chillers, they always strive to build great chillers. Partner with them as you build great beer. Josh Erickson from Chafunkta Brewing Company says, "The team at G&D were a critical part of our 10x expansion, always just a phone call or email away. And thanks to their superior equipment, technology, and documentation, commissioning our new chiller was smooth and straightforward. Now we can't wait until we need to upgrade our existing chiller," end quote. Choose G&D Chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive one free year of remote control and monitoring of your new G&D chiller. And Turnkey Brewery Systems, production line design services, retrofitting processing systems, ProBrew can do all this and more with any brewery, old or new, small or large. With an expansive list of breweries already served, their engineering team prides itself on providing a true turnkey solution built for your entire production line that can be easily customized to fit your operation. For more information, fill out their contact form at www.probrew.com or email contactus@probrew.com to learn exactly how they can take your operations to the next level. ProBrew, brew your beer. Also, are you struggling to source affordable citrus ingredients due to market fluctuations? Try Old Orchard's flavored craft juice concentrate blends, which mimic straight concentrates at a better price point and with a more reliable supply. Old Orchard's citrus-flavored blends include blood orange, grapefruit, lemonade, lime, and tangerine. To learn more and request your free samples, head on over to oldorchard.com/brewer. Jason, we normally kick things off talking about a little bit of history past and some of the steps that got you to where you are today. Talk to me about your history. What got you into brewing and then what led to forming Calusa Brewing here?
Sure thing. So I guess when I was 21 playing video games online, I had a close friend who his family owned a homebrew supply shop. And for my 21st birthday, he sent me a homebrew kit. And I think that recipe was a Newcastle clone. And, you know, it was really fun. I had a great time doing it and sort of like progressed into all grain and homebrewing for competitions. And it just kind of captivated me. Growing and learning more about like classic styles, and then growing up in California as well, just being surrounded by hop forward breweries, just kind of developed a love for it.
So you grew up in San Diego?
I grew up in Ventura.
Okay.
A little north of San Diego. Met my business partners in San Diego through a mutual friend. I at the time was working on a pro forma for a brew pub, and met Jordy, and he was leaving the military and wanting to open a brewery as well. This was probably 2010. And I kind of jokingly said, like, hey, if you need a brewer, let me know. And a couple weeks later, I got a phone call. They had a new pilot system that they did not, you know how to use. So I came down to San Diego and it kind of grew from there.
So how did you end up coming from San Diego down here to Sarasota, Florida? I mean, you're still on the West Coast. It's just a very different West Coast.
Definitely a different West Coast. My business partners grew up on Longboat Key, which is just around the corner from Sarasota. Sure.
Man, I used to vacation in the summers down. I grew up in Orlando, but we would pop on over and get a little condo or something on Longboat Key and have fond childhood memories of Longboat Key.
Very cool. Yeah, my first time here was actually after we had decided to do a brewery together. So I had no experience with Florida.
So they talked you into moving out of California to Florida. Okay.
And it was interesting because in my mind, kind of approaching it with like a sort of, West Coast California understanding of beer, I'm like, okay, I know that Florida's hot and they're probably going to want dry beer that's really drinkable and like Saison and, you know, dry West Coast IPAs. And when we got here, I was really surprised that stouts were like the trend and like the most exciting beer in Florida, which at the time I had to wrap my mind around. And it's interesting to see, I think, as I've been out here, we've seen that hop forward beers have definitely started to make an impact in Florida as well.
It is funny. We should say within that certain craft beer crowd, stouts and fruited Berliner Weisses sour American fruited sour beers were very abnormally popular in Florida relative to their presence in the rest of the beer world.
Absolutely.
You all started Calusa right around the same time that another big trend was gripping that hoppy side of the brewing world, and that was hazy IPA. And so that started figuring into the Calusa story from early on. But let's talk to me, as you all were forming Calusa, you want to start a brewery, but you also want to be, create a reputation around things. What was the idea behind, what was the philosophy that started driving the beers?
We had a sort of tongue-in-cheek kind of slogan for the brewery, which was deliberately fermented warehouse ales, kind of a play on the spontaneously fermented, slogan. And with the intention being that we were going to be a hop-forward brewery that also did some clean and mixed culture barrel aging. And that's kind of been our motto since day one, and it's something that we still stick to. Philosophically, I guess, for myself and my business partners and really most of the employees that work here is kind of the idea that the one thing that separates beer from wine or spirits is drinkability, and we try to express that in really every beer that we do, whether it's a 18 Plato finished gravity stout or a hazy IPA. We still want to consume them, or create something that you can drink multiple of.
Well, that sounds like an interesting subject to dive into, how you build drinkability in a 18 Plato finishing gravity stout. Maybe we will have to get into that subject later. But drinkability underscores that. Was there a stylistic angle? Obviously, you're trying to to be understood, within the context of that kind of mid 20 teens craft beer world and what people expect from a craft brewery at that time, while also staking out some of your own identity through it.
Yeah, I think the way that sort of like hazy IPA worked into that picture was sort of a month or two before we had opened, I had piloted a homebrew batch of a hazy IPA back in 2015. And we decided to add that to our list of six beers when we opened our tap room, and it just kind of flew off the shelf. There was a lot of excitement around it, and at the time, there was maybe a handful of breweries in Florida that were dabbling with that style. So
when did you open?
2016.
Okay,
in April.
That would have been prime hazy time.
Yeah, and it was just it was a lot of fun for us, and really trying to figure out the style because there was so little information on how to brew it properly or what it even took to make it.
Brew it properly. I love it. It's like, yeah. Right. There was very, very little information.
I remember people saying that, you just add flour in the kettle and that's how there's obviously a lot more to it, but
that's the worst way to try to make a hazy IPA, but yeah.
The pilot, I actually did add flour in the kettle and it worked, but you know, we've stopped doing that though. So, yeah. And it kind of grew from there, and we've had an emphasis on just hop forward beer in general. Hoppy lagers, just really anything with hops in it is what excites us. So.
Sure. Sure. Well, I want to dive into, you know, how you construct some of these hoppy beers, you know, and some of the ways that you think about building balance with those, especially down here in Florida where things are warm and you still need to, you need to get people to drink more than one beer, to make their drive out to the tap room worth it, or, you know, their purchase out there in the consumer world. Before we do that, streamline efficiency with Omega Yeast's Diastole Knockout Series. The DKO series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diastole before it starts. The strains you know now better, available now from made-to-order pitchables at any volume. Contact Omega Yeast today at omegayeast.com. Also, ABS Commercial has been a full-service brewery outfitter for over 10 years. They are proud to offer brewhouses, tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brewers across the country, as well as equipment for distilling, cider making, wine making, and more. They know the ins and outs of the brewing and installation process and can design the perfect setup for you. Whether you're just starting out or looking to expand, contact them today at sales@abs-commercial.com to discuss your customized brewery needs. ABS Commercial, we are brewers. So Jason, you know, you started in one place with Hazy IPA. I'm 100% sure you're in a little bit different place now. Let's just fast forward to, you know, 2020, 2021. You know, you have 4 or 5 years of Hazy brewing under your belts. What then, you know, what were some of the major leaps that you all made over those years to get to this kind of point of more stability with Hazy IPA? And, you know, what, as you look at it now over the last 2 years, 3 years, you know, what do you now look at as some of the key, like, pillars and fundamentals of the way that you all construct Hazy IPA?
That's a tough one, I guess. I think we carry that idea of drinkability into really the way we execute beers. But also, I guess, for me personally, and I think a lot of the production crew, like, we tend to lean a little more towards, like, the technical side than like kind of like shooting from the hip. And where I draw a lot of interest from is like the production side or the process side of influencing beer flavor. So, like, our mash tun has rakes and a plow and a steam jacket. So we can't do true decoction by moving the mash into a kettle and boiling separately, but we can boil the mash directly. So, you know, we do lagers and we're doing like pseudo decoction and kind of exploring how we can change the flavor, without having to add, you know, anything specialty malt or stuff like that. Just in general, I guess that's the progression and like the process side of things are what interests us most, but, you know, just keeping drinkability in mind.
Sure. Sure. What is a, you know, let's maybe we start talking about recipe first, and here in Florida, we should probably start by talking about water first. Water is such a, you know, key and important part of Hazy IPA as it's understood. And Florida has some pretty terrible water when it comes to brewing. It's a state surrounded by water. It's a state that, you know, pulls a lot of drinking water from aquifers. And, you know, of course, there's lots and lots of, you know, mineral components to that water as it comes out. So, like, you know, where do you start then as you now think about a Hazy IPA recipe?
Yeah, the water here in Sarasota is a challenge because they're drawing from multiple points and the water table is so shallow that, you know, depending on the time of the year, there could be a lot of rain and the minerality is sort of diluted. Or, you know, time of the year where there's like no rain and it gets really hard. So we just strip everything down with RO, and kind of build up from there. And that's, I think too, at early on, we're one of the first breweries in the area doing that as well. And that's really helped our hop forward beers in general, and pale beers, being able to start with sort of a blank slate.
It's kind of a must now, I think, in Florida, if you're going to build anything with sensitive water characteristics.
Yeah, I think that, you know, really even nationwide, for the most part, if you want to have a diverse array of beer styles, you kind of, you need some RO treatment one way or the other.
Of course, you came from San Diego, which also needed,
Yeah, I kind of picked up the RO thing through Firestone Walker. That was sort of the, like, my home brewery. I didn't work there, but it was just beer that I really, really loved and kind of like tried to take a lot of inspiration from. And I knew that they were using a lot of RO as well.
What a great role model to choose. If you're gonna pick one, Firestone Walker is a great one.
Yeah, their beers are just awesome.
I can't disagree on that for sure. So you strip things down. As you're building up a hazy IPA now, you know, what do you rebuild to?
We typically target around 100 ppm of calcium and about 200 or so of chloride and about 100 sulfate. So that's kind of the starting profile.
Sure, sure. And then, how do you start? Where do you go when your recipe build from there?
We've dabbled a lot with grain bill. And continue to kind of change up the base malts that we're using. And it really just sort of depends on what we are hoping to get from the finished beer. If I want something that's sweeter and still pale, I might go with like a Weyermann Bohemian Pilsner. That tends to finish with a nice malt sweetness that that kind of balances, you know, some intense hopping rates.
Hmm.
So, you know, and then from there,
why is that? That seems counterintuitive to me.
The
why are you spending money on Weyermann, you know, floor malted pills?
Exactly.
To make a hazy IPA.
It just has, especially with hop forward beer or hazy IPA, I want to create something that's pale in color, and Bohemian Pils is pretty pale, but it has a lot of character.
Mm.
And instead of using crystal malts or specialty malts, I find that gives kind of a similar character without having to change the color too much.
Without ruining things, there definitely are, the maltsters are working on this problem too, of trying to find ways to keep that color incredibly light, but also building that flavor. And there are definitely some interesting new malt products in the pipeline that we will talk about in the future here on the podcast. But again, I don't want to spoil things, but I get what you're saying about, about that. What is it about that, you know, that Weyermann Boho floor malted pills versus, you know, say some of the more English approaches to pale malt and the flavor that those can imbue?
And we've experimented with that as well. I've used Maris Otter and a handful of beers. We have a session hazy on right now that uses that as the base. If I want something a little more toasty and a little more rich, then maybe we'll throw that in there. It really just kind of depends. I want to create a line of beers that are different enough from one another without having to use just hops. So by varying the base malts and the type of wheat, really, that'll have a big impact on it.
So when people get their lineup of tasters, that they all have to be a little bit of a different color to them too.
That's the hope. Yeah, you know, subtle
visual tricks. I love it. Yeah,
we definitely get some feedback from customers, and you know, we try to kind of use those cues to, you know, explore different things. But
well, what do your customers want out of that kind of hazy IPA, and then, you know, hazy session IPA or hazy pale ale, and then also on the flip side, hazy double IPA and hazy triple IPA from that kind of color and malt character?
I think, you know, initially and early on, it was definitely a visual cue, you know, so there's a visual expectation of what the beer looks like, obviously. And it's funny, there was a time where the more turbid the beer was, the more excited people got about it, you know, about the beer. But I think we've tried to find a balance between that, where we can have something that looks hazy but is also like smooth, and that kind of comes into play with the type of wheat that we add to those. Again, I'm using a Weyermann pale wheat, which is the lightest wheat I can find. There really isn't another maltster that makes something that pale. And it does contribute to, you know, a half of an SRM difference in the finished beer. So by balancing, you know, the visual side with a smooth mouthfeel and, you know, an intense hop character, that's kind of what I think customers expect.
So what, you know, how do you describe the color then? You know, if you look at like an archetype, like Treehouse Julius, like it is a very orangey color. There have certainly been like more milky and tan or like almost pale beige iterations, which maybe don't quite feel like they don't quite capture the same fruity character as that, that idea of the orange color of Julius. But orange, you know, the Julius has clearly other malt that is driving more significant color than most hazy brewers are brewing with today. And so, you know, where do you, how do you, you know, what are you kind of targeting there? And then how do you kind of tweak and make sure that it stays where you want it to be?
I think for us, it depends on some of the lighter end, which is like our sessionable hazies. They are like a pale straw, almost like a, like in between the zest and the peel of a lemon. And then towards the darker end, we've had some beers that are more of like a burnt orange as well. But that's kind of we want something that glows, really.
That glows.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, does that color get more intense as ABV scales or, you know, because it doesn't necessarily have to. I mean, there's not a rule that says it does. And yet, you know, if you're trying to build some variety there, does that weigh into how you build some things?
As the ABV increases, yeah, there's definitely some color increase, I think, just due to more malt. And then there's some ways that we can counteract that too if we want to try to keep the color back by using a pale pilsner, you know, and pale wheat, that can drive the color back down again.
Yeah, dextrose doesn't add any color, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, but is there, you know, is there some sort of philosophy that drives that, or is that just really based on, are there other things that drive how you want that malt to convey? Because, you know, it's oftentimes, it's not just, you know, the beer is this strength and so it should have this kind of color. You know, it can be, well, I'm going to use these hops and I want them to have a specific malt character to help, you know, create the kind of balance and drinkability that I want out of it. What are some of the other factors that go into your malt choices and how you work around those axes?
I think it's again, to try to create some variety between the grain bill base. And maybe, you know, on one of our sessions, we do a little more of like a toasty profile or like biscuity. And then maybe another one, I'll use some like honey malt to kind of capture a little bit more of like a sweet kind of slick, you know, mouthfeel that kind of complements like citrusy hops. I don't think that we necessarily try to cater the grain bill to the hops that we're using. That kind of gets added in a little bit after, but it's more about like, okay, we've got a Bow Pils base here. This is two row. What's another base that we can use to kind of create some diversity between the base beers?
Are there different kinds of customers who gravitate towards some of these different bases, or is this just, you know, that same kind of adventurous drinker that wants to try different iterations and have enough range within this beer style that they're attracted to?
I don't think we've had customers necessarily notice a difference in the base profile of when it comes to flavor, but we have seen a change visually, even just switching from a domestic wheat to the German wheat. There's, you know, a half an SRM difference in the beer, and it is noticeable. And we have seen customers respond to that, but typically they catch more hop difference than I would say they do the malt in that type of beer.
Sure. Well, then as you're mixing base malt and wheat or other specialty adjuncts, you know, talk me through some of your design process on that. You know, where you tend to end up in terms of, you know, where your percentage splits are. And then if you're using something like honey malt to, you know, capture something in particular, like how does that figure in terms of, you know, percentages versus base malt?
I think we're typically somewhere around 70% base and 20 wheat and 10 oats. The earlier versions back in 2015, 2016, we were more like 90% base and 10% oats and no wheat at all. But we've definitely seen really good benefits to adding wheat to that type of beer. It has added a much more stable haze. And it's contributed to a smoother mouthfeel as well.
Stable haze, like, do you understand? Do you have any thoughts on why?
I mean, I'm not a chemist or a scientist, but as far as I understand, the polyphenol in hop And the protein in malt in general, which is really high in wheat as well, they kind of form together to create a polyphenol matrix. And that is supposedly what creates the haze in those beers. And so anecdotally, when we started adding wheat to the beer, we saw, oh, wow, this is something that's like remaining to the same turbidity throughout the entire life of the beer. And we've also noticed that it smoothed out the mouthfeel, and we just kind of continue going with that.
Are there any mash strategies that you use to also kind of promote that haze stability?
Not necessarily for haze specific purposes, but just on those beers in general. The mashes are pretty dexterous and hard to lauter. And something that has been really nice to have the ability to do is to mash out. That's sped up our lauter times. It's increased the efficiency and kind of locks in sort of the body of the beer. And so all of our hazies get mashed out for sure.
Describe that process for me.
We basically stir the mash and heat it with the steam jacket, and we bring it up to about 175. And then we'll start our Vorloff after that.
Just to completely stop the conversion process.
Yeah. And really we noticed that the lauters got significantly better when we got the mash up above 170. Hmm. So now we go to 175 just to ensure that, as it settles back down, it'll be above 170.
Sure. So 70% base malt, 20% wheat, 10% oats, and every now and then you vary some of those specialty ingredients a little bit?
Yep, absolutely.
Anything, what are some of the favorite variations that come from that?
We've added some biscuit malt, and that has been really cool. I find that kind of works well with the sort of Neo-Mexicanas hops, like the coconutty hops. Having some like biscuity character kind of complements that if we're really trying to drive that like tropical coconut flavor.
Gotta have a little pie crust with your coconut.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
Are figuring out how to make Sabro work, huh?
Yeah. We use it a little bit. I was really excited when it first came out. I remember smelling that at CBC. I was like, whoa, I've never smelt a hop like this. And we got some early released through YCH, and I did the entire dry hop on the first beer that we did. I just sent it, a full 15 barrel batch, and it was intense. Since then, we've pared it back to maybe 20% of the dry hop, and you still get that same intensity, but that hop has a pretty intense mouthfeel too. So by dialing it back, we've been able to keep the flavor and aroma and kind of dial the intensity of that in the mouthfeel down. So
sure. So biscuit malt helps that a little bit. And, are there any other, variations that you find yourself playing with?
Not really. We've kind of done away with, aside from, dabbling here and there, we've done away with the specialty malt and the hazy beer. And we just kind of use the base malt as like the core driver. We've tried honey malt, and I've tried Victory and, some crystal malts, but we always just kind of go back to base malt.
What's your on a standard single IPA? What's your goal SRM for that? Although an SRM, it has to be a flexible concept, since these are not necessarily see-through beers.
Yeah, I would say in like a beer design program, it would come around 3.5 to maybe 4.2 in general. That's kind of where we land.
Cool. Well, we'll talk about ABV and residual sugar later, because again, that all figures into the whole drinkability piece. But let's talk about hot side then. Post mash, as you get in there, what does your hot side process look like in the hazy IPA?
We do some salt additions in the kettle, some acid additions as well. Not a whole lot
What and why?
So we using RO, we need to add some through the lauter. I'm not adding salts during the lauter. Mm. So to make up for that, I add salt back into the kettle. And then the pH adjustments are to kind of offset what was coming in through the lauter as well. I have a little bottle of acid that as we're lautering, I spray the top of the mash because I haven't found a piece of equipment yet that'll allow us to acidify in line as we're laudering. So that's kind of my, you know, little makeup for it. And then we'll also dose in the kettle with a little bit more acid. And mainly we're looking to drive the pH down below 5 post boil. So we'll just kind of get it all in at the start.
Any hop additions through that?
We rarely add anything during the boil, but we do, you know, some significant whirlpool hop additions.
Not even initial bittering charge or?
No, just kind of keep it simple. Mm. And we just do a big whirlpool. And for most beers, we do a low temp whirlpool, and I think a lot lower than, I've got, you know, friends that do them as well. We're aiming for like 155.
What?
Yeah, we go really low. The idea
that's
that
the coolest cool pool that anyone has told me about.
I mean, it's basically like a hot dry hop, and that's the way I look at it.
Yeah,
we've kind of trialed different temperatures, and the idea for me and why we go that low is we can add more to the kettle, and it started more as like a practical thing, but you know, a lot of the yeast that are used in those types of beers are hard to harvest, and it's also hard to harvest a beer that you've done a mid fermentation dry hop on. So my idea was that the lower I could get the low temp whirlpool, the more hop I could get in the kettle, and then still be able to harvest before the dry hop.
Because you're watering back into the kettle and you can then hold more hops that way, or?
By lowering the temperature,
yeah,
you can reduce the IBU contribution. So I could put 33 pounds of whirlpool dry hop and still only have maybe 30 IBUs, where if that was even at 175,
oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, that would be more like 90. So that, you know, it's really a practical thing.
So I can use these so much less efficiently I'm sorry. They're making their aromatic contribution, not their bittering contribution.
Exactly. Yeah. The thing that we've noticed from those really low temp whirlpools is they come across in the finished beer, almost like a mid fermentation dry hop.
Hmm.
So again, it was more of a practical thing because mid fermentation dry hops, they you can't harvest from them. Obviously hop geysers are a thing, and I didn't want to end up on one of those videos. So the idea being that we could take some of that like mid fermentation dry hop or tail end of fermentation dry hop and use it in a low temp whirlpool, and kind of get the best of both worlds. And that's typically what we do on the you know, heavier hop beers.
For this low temp whirlpool, you know, how long is that whirlpool, and what does your kind of temperature adjustment process look like? And then how do hops, you know, hop additions happen in the course of this lower temperature whirlpool?
So we will proceed through the boil as normal, and then at the time of whirlpool, we'll run through the heat exchanger and then back through the whirlpool arm into the kettle and bring the temperature of the kettle down to about 155. And then
all through the heat exchanger, and you're not adding water back into this. Okay.
Not adding water. We'll just cool it down. And then, at that point we'll cut the heat exchanger off and whirlpool as normal and add our hops in.
How long of contact time then do you leave the hops on?
So we will do a 10-minute spin and rest for 20 minutes. And then we'll start our knockout, and that could take anywhere from an hour. So
are you worried at all? I mean, down at that temperature, you're in a, you know, kind of dangerous space in terms of potential beer spoilers.
You know, I haven't, we've sent, samples off throughout the production of, one of our distribution beers, which is a hazy, and we've had no contamination issues. And I think the big worry, especially with low temp whirlpools, is sort of, DMS formation. And by getting the temp down below 180, 190, I think we've avoided that as well. The lid's closed at that time. The kettle itself, you know, the top of the kettle is still, you know, 190 degrees, and I don't think a whole lot's going to be getting in there. So
those hops have a decent antibacterial effect on their own,
absolutely,
too. And then since you're jamming it full, they're helping you do some work.
Absolutely.
So you then, knock out and talk to me about the process from there.
Pretty straightforward. We'll ferment kind of in the mid 60s typically. We'll bump for D-Rest about halfway through fermentation.
London Ale 3 or a different yeast approach?
We toy around with it, but mainly London Ale 3. But we've used Conan 05, actually, a handful of other yeasts, but London Ale is kind of the go-to. We'll bump for D-Rest.
Is there a specific provider that you guys love, or you flip around on that?
I've tried pretty much everyone, but I go back to BSI. London Ale, I believe, goes by A18, and with the low temp whirlpools and kind of refining our harvesting techniques, like, I've been going 50-60 generations on a pitch from them.
What?
The last one we just re-upped. And our last pitch went like 76 generations.
76 generations.
76. And I only replaced it just because I felt like I should. We were seeing really no difference in performance or pH or
hay stability. Right there.
No change, but I just kind of felt, I was like, this seems wrong. but yeah, you know, we even did triangles when we got the new yeast generation in, and side by sides, and no one could pick out the control. So,
76 generations. Now, when I talked to the folks from Grimm Artisanal Ales in Brooklyn, they were at 150 generations on their London Ale 3, and we're continuing. And I think they're over 200 something now, with that intention of it just becoming and remaining its own yeast in the same way, like, you know, but this whole family of yeast has also, you know, grown and developed over 100 years before this, before we isolated all of that into what it was. And so, you know, it's part of that yeast's just, you know, natural development. Interesting though, that it's remained as stable as that for you, even over 76 generations.
Yeah, but I thought maybe initially that if it did start to develop its own character or some sort of mutation, that maybe that could, you know, potentially be a sure. unique thing for us. But it stayed really consistent. And I guess when you think about it, right, like, yeast is, it's millions of generations. We're just, you know, we might be starting with a lab pitch, but that started somewhere and you know, so forth. But,
well, tell me how you keep yeast healthy, because that is the key component to maintaining that many generations of yeast is really low stress. Like, you know, if you stress your yeast out, it is not going to last 76 generations for you. So you must be using some techniques to very gently care for this in each fermentation.
Well, I think, I mean, the lack of mid-fermentation dry hop does, like, hops kind of stress yeast out and cover them up in oil, and that has an impact on viability. Something that was important for us, and we saw an immediate increase in viability, was soft crash. And, you know, as soon as the beer's done, you know, getting the temp down below, you know, 60 was a 10% increase in viability on our harvest. And that was at the point where we went from, you know, in the 80s on viability at the time of harvesting, like, into the high 90s. And so, you know, after our D-rest, and as soon as the beer's done and we see, you know, stable gravity, we pass VDK, and we see typically like a slight increase in pH too. Like, we know, okay, it's time to, like, cool the beer down and get the yeast out of there as soon as we can. So, and it's, I guess, kind of the soft crash for us was like, whoa, like, we really, like, found something there. And yeah, just treating it well, keeping pressure off of it once it's harvested, and just using it as soon as we can.
Do you keep pressure pretty low in the tanks themselves as it's fermenting?
Yeah. We keep
them zero.
Yeah. Pretty much zero until we soft crash, and then we'll put some positive pressure on the tank. But it's only a few PSI.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, if I recall, I think that was a big piece of it, you know, because this London Ale strain has lived most of its ancient life in open tanks and in open vats. It just doesn't love that pressure, and that's one healthy way to keep it going. Anyway, I want to talk a little bit more about this, but first, SS Brewtech was founded by a group of home and craft beer brewers dedicated to bringing an engineering-first approach to brewery equipment. SS Brewhouses are used to formulate new beer recipes at some of the world's greatest breweries and are the cornerstone of many local breweries. To learn more about SS Brewtech's innovation list, head on over to ssbrewtech.com. Also, have you heard of Christian Hansen? They are the fermentation experts with over 100 years of experience in dairy and wine, and they are now bringing that knowledge of microbes to brewers with their SmartBev range of frozen liquid yeast and freeze-dried bacteria. This portfolio allows for consistent performance at the brewery and produces a range of high-quality brews. Reimagine what your beer can be. Go to chr-hansen, that's H-A-N-S-E-N.com, to learn more on the Smart Bev line of products. And the 2024 California Craft Beer Summit's Expo Floor is a place to connect, learn, and get business done. Featuring over 150 industry partners, shop talks covering business and technical brewing trends, chef and beer pairings, beer tastings, and much more. Learn how to grow your business, adjust to dynamic industry changes, and set it up for long-term success. Go to cacraftbeersummit.com and grab your tickets for your whole team today. So 76 generations, that's awesome. And I love walking into interviews like this, having no idea that you're that crazy, and then discovering these crazy things about people that you're willing to share like that. But such a cool process. So then talk about how you soft crash and then you dry hopping.
Absolutely. We'll harvest for a couple of days. We want to get as much of the yeast out as the beer, out of the beer prior to the dry hop. And our dry hops are, we're not doing super crazy numbers. We have explored in the past with like 10 pounds per barrel. We typically will be anywhere between 3 to 5.
So you soft crash, you leave it down there at that temperature, you raise it again before you start dry hopping.
I like to dry hop cooler, I guess. We've experimented with that. I dry hopped a beer at 32 just to see what would happen and wasn't too pleased with the results.
Sure.
There's still some yeast activity going on. And when you soft crash, but when you get it that cold, it just tastes like pure raw hops. So, for us, we're typically, in between 50 and 60, when we dry hop. And, we'll do like a 3 or 5 pound per barrel dry hop. And then, we recirc the tank as well. And we also rouse with CO2. So we've kind of...
You're pumping and you're rousing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Originally, I was just using CO2, but I was still noticing big rafts of hops on top of the beer, even days after. And it started recircing to under pressure to get as much contact with the hops as we could, but we do it for a really short period of time. Just to get everything in solution and make sure it's incorporated, and then we kind of let it do its thing. But we will
say short time. What does that mean?
Typically, the idea with the recirc is to recirculate the tank twice. And so on our 15s, that's like 2 hours. And on our 30s, that's about 4 hours. And we'll also rouse with CO2. We'll do short bursts of CO2 during the recirc. And you can visually see in the sight glass and in samples pulled, like, as you're doing the burst, the beer just gets greener and greener and just saturated with hops. And that's kind of what we're making sure to do.
Greener from the top, greener from the side, like, where is it getting greener?
So we will pump into the total outlet, the very bottom of the fermenter. Mm. And I've actually had our tank set up with a tangential port at the top of the tank. So we'll draw from that into the pump. So I haven't put a video camera inside the fermenter, but the idea being that we can create a small whirlpool in the tank. And
you're trying to pull that hop matter into the actual recirc itself.
Trying to pull it from the top of the tank and blow it back up through the bottom.
Okay.
And so that's kind of the concept there. And even once the recirc's going, we don't see that the beer is fully saturated until we've done those CO2 blasts as well.
Hmm.
And I think, that gives us kind of the best of both worlds. We're getting the hops into solution and extracting as much flavor and aroma as we can, with also trying to limit, the shear that's happening in the pump and creating a lot of polyphenol bitterness. So that's kind of where the sweet spot that we found is.
That's true. You don't want to cut up those hops too much and, get some of the less desirable things out of it.
Exactly.
Are there any other techniques that you use to kind of, pull the aromatic compounds, but leave some of those, more rough and bitter or even like grassy or OG characters behind?
We've seen some things that have that we've experienced that we just kind of avoid now, I guess. When we first got a centrifuge, I had this like idea, like I'm going to turn a hop forward beer from grain to glass in like 6 days. Right. And we did it and it tasted great. But one thing that we noticed was, there was only roughly a 24 hour period between, the time that we dry hopped and, the time that we transferred through the centrifuge into the bright tank. And, that short period of time, what we noticed in that beer was that it was like incredibly dank. Like it smelled like chronic, you know? And I'm like, okay, well, why could that happen? And reading in some hop, you know, journals and, you know, stuff that's way above my level. One of the things I picked out was that, terpenes are one of the first things to settle out in beer. So that first 24 hours is typically where that settles out. And since we had transferred so soon after that, we just made we just filled the bright tank with terps. And so, you know, we were like, okay, we can't do that again. So that, you know, we created like roughly like a 3-day window now from the time that we crashed to the time that we centrifuge. And that leaves a lot of that in the tank so that it's not making it up in the bright. So
interesting.
Just little anecdotal stuff that we've come across that, you know, kind of goes back to like, I'm just really interested in the way that process can affect that beer, and the fact that, oh, we gave it 24 hours of crash wasn't enough. Like that little change there's important to me.
There's some things that a centrifuge can, you know, accelerate the settling out of, and then there are some things that it cannot replace just because of particle size and everything else. And that,
yeah, I mean, we're trying to keep the beer hazy as well. Like with the centrifuge, I could completely clarify that. So we're trying to just really polish it up and remove anything that would might, you know, be harsh. But the terps can make it through, it turns out. So
sure. And then you know, how do you then, you know, finish from there?
We do a really slow and gentle sort of trickle carbonation with it's a rotameter. It's basically we trickle in like a few liters per minute, and we'll carbonate very slowly overnight. Hmm. Sometimes it takes about 24 hours. The idea there just being to, you know, kind of reduce as much foaming as possible, and you know, kind of straightforward from that point. You know, either keg it or can it.
Cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about you know, the creative side of that. Obviously, as you mentioned at the top, the technical problem solving is one of your primary focuses. But, you know, when it comes to creating a variety of beers for your customers to try, you know, hops also play a big role in that, and how you build combinations and build flavors for them, you know, can be a make or break for it. So talk to me about the creative process here at Calusa, you know, for building hop combos in your hoppy hazy IPAs.
I think that really starts with hop selection. We have a really good relationship with Yakima Chief, and we select a majority of the hops that we're using every year. And that in and of itself is a really like interesting experiment, I guess would be the best way to describe it, because you know, over time we've kind of found what we like on the table, but you never really know what the hop is going to act like until it gets into beer. But developing some parameters there of like how, like what we go for when we select, that really starts. And then at that point we kind of like, okay, like our Citra this year is like really peachy. What can we use that might complement that? Or, you know, our Mosaic is really dank this year. Like what can we do to, especially on our flagship beer that we're trying to remain consistent with, how do we use these hops together to stay consistent? And then in terms of combinations, it's really just like with Sabro, okay, like we love the coconut, but how do we tame some of that like juniper and pine and some of the other sides of that? So it's kind of like a balancing act, really.
Do you do this yourself? Do you do this with a team? Do you use, you know, using you know, spec sheets on these, spider graphs? Is there some, you know, what's that creative process feel like?
I've got a production team of four people right now. And we will typically, you know, if we were at selection and we had a hop that maybe was a fresh hop that we were like, wow, like we really, you know, we're really excited about this, we'll try to like incorporate that into the program as well. The creative side of hops is, you know, I'll refer to the spider graphs, or you know, like if we're doing a West Coast, it kind of starts at the base, right? Like, okay, we want to do like a piney West Coast, like obviously Simcoe and Columbus and some of the classic hops are there, but like BSG's working on a few that are a few experimental hops that are pretty piney too, so we might like dabble in the experimentals. That's actually a pretty big part of what we do with the hop program. We've got actually the Vienna Lager, which kind of funny. I was digging through Vienna Lager recipes. I wanted to do something that's a little more classic than like the modern American version. And your guys' website actually came up for a Vienna Lager recipe. And what I found interesting about it was one of them had Maris Otter in the Vienna Lager recipe. And I actually used that. I was like, oh, that sounds cool, like a way to get like toasty bready. So in the Vienna Lager that we just packaged 2 days ago, that we can try later, that one has a little inspiration from you guys. So even just digging around and seeing what other people are doing.
That sounds like something Josh Weichert would do. if I'm thinking about why that's on our web. No, I'm glad that that's what the reference is there for. Yeah.
But on that beer as well, we've got an experimental hop that is a American grown attempt at like a noble hop.
Hmm.
It's 1134 is the experimental HBC, and we've been dabbling with that for the past year. I've done an Italian Pilsner and a few other beers, but you know, it's kind of using. I like trying new things and kind of exploring, and so maybe not as romantic. You know, I'm definitely not like, we've got some employees or our old tasting room manager, he could talk about beer and he was so romantic about it, where I'm a little more of like the technical kind of like practical side of things. But for me, what's exciting is like something new or even just like taking a risk.
Sure. What, you know, in terms of the beers that translate in the most compelling ways to that your customers, you know, what are those things that they respond to in the most significant ways?
You know, when we opened, it was absolutely hazy IPA, but,
or I should say, is it Citra Mosaic like it is for everybody else?
you know, I mean, and I think just in general, like hop forward beers have always been the best sellers.
Yeah.
And you know, I love hops. That's just kind of the way it is. But there are different ways to approach that. And, with that being said, we've absolutely seen a shift in the past 2 years as towards, at least with our customer base, about what they prefer to drink and what they're gravitating towards. And not just
post-pandemic shift, huh?
I think so. I think, you know, it's everyone during the pandemic was probably consuming a little more alcohol than in previous years, but, and maybe that's caused everyone to, okay, like I want to tone it. Like I want to drink something a little more, you know, approachable, or, it's not necessarily lagers that, our customers have been enjoying a lot lately. We did a collab with Green Bench actually, about 8 months ago, that was a English Golden Summer Ale and a real ode to like Boddington's really. And customers love that, you know? And I think too, with our new location, we've got food there. We've seen a shift just in the month that we've been open in what people are buying, you know, and through toast and everything. And people are gravitating more towards like lower ABV, and lagers. So it's fun to kind of explore that and, you know, it gives us a new challenge, a new avenue to play around with beer.
Changing the taproom context like that, and one variable like having consistent food, changes the beers that people order from you in the taproom.
Absolutely. And I think too, for us, you know, the idea of creating, you know, beer, it can be more than just ingredients, but kind of like capturing that moment where the beer's there, but it's adding to the experience, and you bring food into that, and you can kind of create a whole package, I guess.
I want to ask one more hop question before we move on.
Sure.
You know, what was the most, was there an unsuspecting hop combination that you found either you or your customers connected with in a way that you wouldn't have thought about before you launched something like that? There's some beer that you found a mix in, like, huh, I didn't think this would work, and now it really does, and people are digging it.
Yeah, I think that A good example of that would be we have two beers in distribution, very limited distribution. It's mainly just local. And one of those is a lager that was inspired a bit by Two Hearted. Two Hearted's one of my all-time favorites. I love Centennial. It's funny. I know a lot of people are not huge on Centennial, but for whatever reason, I gravitate towards it. One of our customers had loved a dry hop Pilsner, one of our accounts, and we used to use Saphir in that. And it was a basically 100% Saphir dry hop Pilsner. And I love Two Hearted. We did a collab with his company called Florida Flavor. They're a local clothing company. And so we named this beer Florida Flavor. And we took his love for our dry hop Pilsner and my love for Two Hearted and combined that into one beer. So Saphir and Centennial together. And customers loved it so much that we decided to put it out into distribution. So it's sort of like a 5.5%. Hop forward, slightly malty amber lager. And yeah, just Saphir and Centennial work really well together.
Interesting and unusual. And you're right, I never would have guessed. Well, you know, before we get out of here, I want to, you know, talk about this idea. As you mentioned at the top, drinkability. That's key to what you do, even in a 18 Play-Doh finishing gravity barrel aged stout. Yeah, again, we're in Florida. The Floridian palate has never found a sweet beer that they didn't like. Shouldn't say that. I was born in Florida. I am a native Floridian, strangely enough. So I can say these things.
You can say it.
And don't cancel me for it, Florida. And again, you know, most of my family lives in Florida in one place or another. But Florida loves sweet beers. And, but while at the same time, you're in a place where it's 80 to 90 degrees highs for, you know, a good 10 months out of the year for the most part. When you talk about building drinkability in big and sweet beers, you know, what are some of the techniques that you use to help find that kind of balance? Obviously, you know, bitterness and carbonation are some nice balances. Are there other tools at your disposal, you know, especially on these big high gravity, high alcohol beers?
I think the most important one is the barrel, is a barrel. The bitterness the tannin that wood can provide can really cut through some of the, you know, intense malt character. And our barley wine before it goes into a barrel is wildly big and chewy, and you know, a year or two in the barrel really mellows that out, and adds like some bitterness and char and tannin that can make that, you know, drinkable.
Are you designing that for that specifically long aging in order to hit that kind of extraction?
Absolutely, yeah. I have found that I just really like you know, the low levels of oxidation that happen in those big beers that are aged for 2 years plus. I feel like they really hit this like magical spot after about 2 years. And a lot of that is oxidation, but it's also just the wood kind of rounding that intensity out.
But do you think that higher, finishing gravity in these is buffering some of the oxidative effects of that barrel aging?
Yeah, absolutely. The alcohol and just the high residual sugar can balance out the oxidation for sure.
So for a barley wine that you brew, you know, what does it go into the barrel at, generally speaking, in terms of alcohol and in terms of gravity?
We'll start around anywhere between 30 to 34 Play-Doh, and after fermentation they'll typically be 16 to 18.
Going still pretty sweet after fermentation.
Yeah, that's where IPAs start usually, but they'll go in there, and then it's interesting depending on the weather. Even though we keep our beers in what's now our old tap room, but depending on the time of the year and the way that the air conditioning kicks on and how hot it gets in here, we've seen if it's really hot and humid, that alcohol will start evaporating from the barrel and the beer will get even sweeter. And then on the opposite side of that, if it's been really cold, we've seen that the water will evaporate from the barrel and, you know, the ABV and everything goes up. So it's an interesting thing, but Yeah, the long-term aging is definitely, like, you know, balanced out, and the, just oxidation in general is a really, like, in low levels is something I really like.
That's interesting, because, you know, where we are in the, you know, high desert of the Mountain West, like, it's only water evaporating.
Yeah. In the summer in here, even with air conditioning, it's still like 80% humidity, and it's just too, there's nowhere for that water to go. So the alcohol goes.
Interesting. Interesting. Anyway, let's pull out and, you know, look at a big, you know, finish up with a big picture question here. You know, you guys launched in 2016, you know, you found hits and beers that connected with people and hazy IPA, you know, mimicking these, finding these kind of fruity, hoppy characters that, you know, that also have enough structure for people to drink regularly here. But with that kind of depth of flavor that attracts people to this new thing that's worth seeking out and worth continuing to come back for, you know, as you think about the next, you know, 3 to 5 years for Colusa, what do you think, you know, the next 3 to 5 years of brewing are going to look like compared to, you know, the last 5 years of brewing?
That's, I wish I had had like a, I knew the answer to that question. For us, I guess what, you know, as we've matured as a company and as craft beer in general has matured, our focus now is as much about beer as it is the experience of having that beer. And we're going to, you know, maybe 6 years ago, our goal was to just make the best beer possible. And we were sitting, you know, on a pallet of grain, essentially sharing that with customers. Now it's to provide a little bit of everything with beers that complement the food that we have, following our passion with beer in general and creating things that you can create, you can consume in abundance, but still, you know, be relatively coherent.
Sure. Sure. You know, what's the long-term view for the business? What do you all hope to achieve with Colusa?
I think really we just, we wanted to, you know, essentially be our own bosses, and do that through, what was a hobby that we loved and just continue the just trying to make the most intense hop forward beers that we can.
Well, we will bring it to a close on that. G&D Chillers always strives to build great chillers. ProBrew can help you with turnkey brewing systems, production line design, and retrofitting processing systems. Are you having trouble sourcing affordable citrus ingredients due to market fluctuations? Try Old Orchard's flavored craft juice concentrate blends. Streamline your efficiency with Omega Yeast's Diastole Knockout Series. ABS Commercial has been a full-service brewery outfitter for over 10 years. SS Brewtech is dedicated to bringing an engineering-first approach to brewing equipment. Christian Hansen are the fermentation experts with over 100 years of experience. And the 2024 California Craft Beer Summit Expo floor is the place to connect, learn, and get business done. If you've enjoyed this podcast or any others, go to thebeerandbrewing.com website, click on the subscribe button there, and let us know that what you are listening to here and what you read every quarter in our issues of Craft Beer Brewing Magazine matter to you. Plus, we've got great stuff that shows up in the magazine, recipes, etc., from great brewers that you don't get here on the podcast and can only get through Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. And if you are a brewery in planning, go to breweryworkshop.com. Check out our upcoming Brewery Accelerator in Austin, March 24th through 27th. Jason, if people want to learn more about Colusa or try your beers, whether that's buying them in stores or checking them out here in real life or just checking out what you do out there on the internet, where can they find more about Colusa?
We are at colusabrewing.com and Instagram and Facebook.
Cool. Well, thanks for talking to me about brewing and especially about the way that you make Colusa Hazy IPA. Cheers.
Cheers. Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those who love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew.